Going the wrong way on valley freeways has become a too common occurrence in recent months, leading to several fatal accidents. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about what the State Department of Transportation is trying to do to fix the problem. Is it about signage or impaired drivers? Plus, Arizona's clean election system of public campaign financing has taken some hits, including the loss of its matching funds provision. What's the current condition of the system, and do its enforcement provisions make sense? The Phoenix Suns surprised most observers with an exciting 2013-2014 NBA season, but the team's future probably depends on signing and drafting the right young players. The NBA draft is tomorrow, and the Suns have 3 first-round picks. What will they do? And actress and comedy writer Jenny Molin has just had her first book published. It's called I Like You Just the Way I Am. We'll talk about Molin's sense of humor and about being the daughter of a well-known Valley doctor. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with Tom Collins, Executive Director of Arizona's Citizens Clean Elections Commission. At least a few of the state's gubernatorial candidates have pursued public funding, along with a number of legislative candidates. So what kind of shape is the system in? Doug McCachran of the Arizona Republic will also tell us what he thinks. McCachran wrote a recent column that was extremely critical of clean elections. Also, the National Basketball Association draft will be held tomorrow. The Phoenix Suns have 3 first-round picks. Has a surprisingly successful 2013-2014 season changed the team's priorities? If they keep their picks, what might their choices be? We'll ask Kevin Zimmerman, who covers the Suns for valleyofthesuns.com. Plus, actress and comedy writer Jenny Molin has just had her first book published. We'll talk about what it's like to be a funny female with a well-known husband and a locally famous dad. We start today's program with wrong-way drivers. In May, 3 fatal head-on collisions in 1 week led to 7 deaths and a huge meeting between law enforcement and transportation officials. And this past Monday, a wrong-way driver caused a crash that led to an early morning closure on the Hohokam Expressway. That driver had a suspended license for a prior DUI. Earlier this morning, the Arizona Department of Transportation displayed safety measures, including sign changes intended to stop wrong-way driving. Here with me in studio to talk about that is Doug Ninsel of ADOT. Doug, good morning.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So what happened this morning? What's going to change?
Well, it's important to note that it really is a next step in the entire process of the battle against the wrong-way driver. And we have certainly had signs in place at Valley Freeway interchanges along the off-ramps, and most drivers wouldn't really pay attention to those because they're going the correct way. But we have decided, in the wake of the rash of crashes that we've had, that there are some things we have to look into, and we have done that and said that we're going to change out signs at 6 interchanges in order to study the effectiveness of doing something like that. So we have it's interesting to try to describe all these sign changes, but closest to the end of an off-ramp, there are do not enter signs. And what we've done is expand the size of those really from 30 inches by 30 inches up to 48 inches by 48 inches. So a significant change in the size of those signs. We are also below that adding the words on a sign, wrong way. And we have plenty of wrong way signs out there already, but we are doing that. And we are lowering both signs so that they are, at their bottom point, they are 3 feet above the ground. So, again, improving, hopefully, the line of sight for a wrong-way driver to maybe notice these signs. Mm. And then we've also taken the step with pavement markings to add large arrows with lane stripes and also red reflectors. The arrow is pointing the right way along the exit ramp. The red reflectors would be facing a wrong-way driver. And so these are a couple of steps that we've taken in the near term. Again, it's 6 interchanges.
Yeah, what 6 are we talking about, Doug?
Well, we're talking about on I-17 at Carefree Highway in the North Valley, the Loop 101 in the West Valley at Thunderbird and Peoria, and along I-10 headed down in the direction toward Tucson, but still in the valley at Railroad in the Ahwatukee area, also Wild Horse Pass Boulevard, and then also Queen Creek Road, which is also known as State Route 347.
Doug, you've been doing this for a long time. Sorry for saying that, but you have. Have we ever seen a string of this? What do these things share in common? I mean, is this something where we're talking about the signs really weren't big enough, or in each of these situations, have they been impaired drivers?
Yeah, and we're certainly not going to be able to point to signage as being the issue. What, unfortunately, we have to point to is impaired drivers, and that's what all these crashes have had in common. Impairment of one type or another, usually along the lines of alcohol. And I'm glad you brought it up, Steve, because it is an important point. We've gotten together with DPS and the Governor's Office of Highway Safety, and we have said, you know, what are some of the things we can do? We concentrate on the three E's, those being engineering, enforcement, and education. ADOT is mostly aligned with the engineering part of things. So that's why we're going to see what we can do when it comes to things like sign changes. But we're also going to continue research efforts to say, what is the problem that we have to identify here in Arizona? And what types of things can we research to say, is it possible to put some additional systems in place? Because we know that folks are going to say, hey, the impaired driver is going to, they're not going to see these sign changes. They're not going to see the red reflectors. What else are you going to do? And that's what we're going to do over a little bit of the longer term, that is to do some research.
And I presume, first part of my question, that we haven't seen anything. I mean, this has been quite a string. I mean, in May, there were three accidents, and now one earlier this week. It seems bizarre.
No, I can't recall a string like this with the wrong way crashes that are tragically fatal. I can't remember, and I've been at ADOT for 18 years. I can't remember something like that. It is interesting to note that in all of this, DPS is now talking about the fact that they have on average about 25 calls that come in about wrong way drivers out there on the state highway system each month. 25 calls. And in most of those cases, the drivers do figure out they're going the wrong way, and they do
these
correct.
These are 25 different situations.
Exactly.
Okay.
25 different situations where there's a wrong way driver reported out there. But it's also interesting to say that, you know, fatal crashes are random events. And it is interesting to try to study why is this happening suddenly, because you can go months at a time without another fatal crash occurring. We do know that. This certainly has gotten our attention, and that's why we've stepped up and said, here are some things we're going to look at in the near term. We also need to know, we know that it's not the final answer. We know that we have to continue to research systems that might someday be put in place to warn drivers who are going the right way on the freeway, but also is there some other system that we can have that might further alert the wrong way driver that they've got to stop. They're doing the wrong thing.
Doug, without speculating too much, next week, 4th of July holiday, starts on a Friday. That means a long weekend. I mean, is this something that ADOT and DPS have talked about as well? Obviously, we're going to have the patrols to make sure to check out people who may have been drinking, but considering the concern about impaired drivers, how does the timing on this work, in essence, to make sure people are more aware of this?
Well, it is important to get the word out to watch for something like this when it comes to the wrong way drivers. But also, when you're talking about a holiday weekend, it's associated with travel. Any time like that, we're going to be working to get the word out about the safe driving habits that people have to really be thinking about. That is to prepare ahead of a trip, to get plenty of rest before you're going to be traveling. And right up there is going to be no drinking and driving. And it is going to be, if you're going to be having fun with friends or family, make sure you're making the arrangements on the designated driver. And I think that's where it ties in. We're always talking about these things. But when it comes to wrong way travel, again, talking to the Department of Public Safety, they are now saying, you know, it's a good idea if you're out at night when these crashes are most likely to occur, you want to be traveling really in the center lane of the freeway, avoiding the HOV lane, and maybe that next lane over, we call it the number one or left lane, and maybe sticking to the center of the freeway. in order to give yourself some space for evasive action. We certainly hate to have to talk about something like that, but the reality is, hey, it is something that we're asking drivers to now think about.
Doug Nintzel of the Arizona Department of Transportation. Doug, thanks as always.
You bet, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal is now known by a couple of other names, Falcon 9 and Thucydides. Those are two aliases he's been using over the past few years to post on some blog sites. He's commented on FDR and Hitler, along with Child Protective Services and Planned Parenthood. Hoopenthal has been criticized for the problems, and now a number of high-profile people are calling for him to resign. That includes former school superintendent Lisa Graham Keegan, who will join us in a moment here. Lisa, can you hear me? Lisa cannot hear me. We'll go to Lisa Graham Keegan in just a moment. Doug Nintzel, meanwhile, as long as you're still here with me, I did have one more question for you, as long as we have the time. Last time we spoke, we talked about the One Less Spark, One Less Wildfire campaign. How has that been going?
Well, you know, we're off to that start where we are going to continue to work with the departments that are involved in fighting fires. And so we're going to really be stepping that up this summer with public awareness campaigns. But again, One Less Spark, One Less Wildfire really goes to the heart of the matter we're talking about, even holiday travel coming up. And that is to make sure that you're doing things such as not, if you have a trailer to pull and you're traveling, make sure that the chain is not dragging on the pavement. That could create sparks that wind up on the side of the highway and spark a wildfire. And very quickly, if you need to pull over for any reason, try to do so in an area that doesn't have the taller grasses or brushes, because the hot engine parts, the hot parts underneath your vehicle, could start a fire as well. So that's what we're stressing as we head into, I guess, the hottest part of the summer. We're getting there with the 4th of July. So that's really what that campaign's all going to be about. Things that drivers can do to help us avoid wildfires that could be started as a result of, I'll call it, activity along our highways.
Doug, what about the summer in general? Is that a time where we see more road construction, less? What's going on? What are some of the big projects we should know about?
You know, the good news along our Arizona highways is that we have the nice weather year-round, and we have a lot of construction that can continue year-round. Obviously, in the high country, we have some shutdowns for a construction season, but we're able to keep up with things statewide. I will quickly say that what we're looking forward to in the Phoenix area are three projects to start a little bit later this summer. First of all, along the Loop 101 in the Scottsdale region, adding an extra travel lane in each direction along the 101 between Shea Boulevard and the Red Mountain Freeway, Loop 202. In the Northwest Valley along Loop 303, we're going to be starting an expansion project of Loop 303, again, adding an extra lane in each direction to get that to three lanes in each direction between Grand Avenue and Happy Valley Parkway. Those are two of the key projects. And then also along Interstate 10 in the Chandler region, adding what we call the merge lanes or auxiliary lanes in between Wild Horse Pass Boulevard and Queen Creek Road. We're going to be adding that additional capacity for travel. A lot of folks who leave for Tucson note that traffic really slows down in that area of I-10. So adding these additional lanes, we're looking to give that some additional capacity for people to make their moves on and off the freeway and hopefully help with the overall flow of traffic there.
Doug Nintzel of ADOT. Doug, thank you again.
You bet, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the situation around Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal, and a little bit later this hour, actress and comedian Jenny Molin, who is the daughter of a well-known local doctor. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum, presenting Hollywood Costume. Nearly 100 costumes from a century of filmmaking, highlighting how costume design becomes a key component in cinema storytelling. Now on view, phxart.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ 91.5 FM. Well, we've got sunny skies across Arizona at this hour. It's 75 degrees right now in Flagstaff, 85 in Prescott, 97 in Casa Grande, it's 96 in Tucson, and 96 in Yuma. Well, in a check of World Cup games, Argentina beat Nigeria 3-2 this morning, and Bosnia beat Iran 3-1. This afternoon, Honduras takes on Switzerland, and Ecuador plays France at 1 o'clock. On the I-10 westbound, a crash is blocking the exit ramp at 67th Avenue. Sunny skies and 99 degrees in Phoenix at 11:21.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal has been under fire quite a bit for comments he's made about Child Protective Services and Planned Parenthood and FDR and Hitler, among other things. Hoopenthal has been criticized for the comments, and now a number of high-profile people are calling for him to resign. That includes former school superintendent Lisa Graham Keegan, who joins me now. Lisa, good morning.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
I'm good. So what's the most egregious part of what Mr. Hoopenthal has said or written so far?
I believe the egregious aspect of all of this is the disdain, the attitude of disdain towards the people that we work for and work with or on behalf of. And people get to believe whatever they want to believe, and vigorous debate is all. That's great. That's part of life and certainly part of the political world. But when you are the superintendent of schools in Arizona, you represent families who come from across the spectrum, and the first order of business is to constantly be respectful, to constantly be seeking higher ground. And you undermine that completely when you say the kind of things that he's been saying anonymously. He obviously knew this wasn't okay to say in Arizona, that you couldn't say it out loud as yourself, or people would have the reaction that we're all having. And I have to say, Steve, this is not the person that I knew. I am sick about it. I had no idea it was coming. All of the conversations I have had are people saying that same thing. This is not typical of the man that I've known for 20 years. And I hate the fact that I'm even on the phone with you talking about this, to tell you the truth. But Arizona can't be a place where you can say these things.
Lisa, there are going to be some, of course, who are going to say, okay, we're upset that he said those things, but he was elected and he shouldn't have to resign because of it. I mean, is this one of those things where you and some others are encouraging him, or do you think there is going to be something really terribly serious if he sticks with this and continues in his run for reelection?
So it's strictly my opinion, because I hold this job in such high regard, right? I have the honor of holding it for a while for the public. And I think that Jaime Molera, for example, is not calling for him to resign. He's just simply saying, look, I'm not going to support you anymore. So whatever happens next is not going to be with you. As far as Jaime is concerned, my belief is that the work we have to do is so urgent for children. We don't have 5 minutes to spare, much less 6 months. And you lose the confidence of teachers and educators when you speak like this. Teachers, more than anybody, are a breed that listens to respect. They have to work with all children and see what's best about them and move those kids to their capacity. And they do not work well with people who are speaking in these disdainful terms. And I said to John that I thought he has lost the confidence of the people he has to work with, which is why I said to him, I think you'll have to resign. I don't see how you move your agenda forward. I don't see how you help all of us move forward in this position. So that's just me, Steve. I understand people have a lot of different opinions about it.
So clearly you're saying, which is probably the most important thing, Lisa, is that you just think it's going to make him less effective as superintendent.
It has already made him less effective as superintendent. There's no question. And I don't think it's recoverable. It's a bell that doesn't get unrung when you say those things. No matter what you say next, right, everybody's just focused on that. And particularly because John has not recanted those statements. He said he's sorry if people are offended.
Right.
But that's a horrible, you know, we've all had that apology. I'm sorry that you're mad.
Right.
But I'm not sorry for what I said, and I have a right to say these things. Of course, yeah, you can be as horrible as you want, and you should probably be on cable television. That we understand that gets done. Mm-hmm. But the habit of mind that leads you to say something like that discloses something none of us wanted to know about the superintendent, but apparently this is real. And it makes you unsuitable in the position today, which is why I think it's really important that he would step aside. I think that he won't, Steve. I think that he won't. And that's up to him. And yes, he is an elected leader. And now the public just has to decide, is that what they want?
Lisa, until this point, did you think he was doing a good job?
I did on most occasions, Steve. I did. We've been colleagues and opponents for, you know, two decades. And of course, but in the main, we have, I think his vision for what he wanted to see, I thought, was achievement across the board. I want to continue to believe that this is a basically good person. I don't know what happened here. So yes, and that's what makes it particularly painful. On the big, big issues of, you know, excellence and access to excellence and all those sorts of things, I have felt like he was really working on behalf of us all. So it's particularly discouraging to hear these things.
Lisa, I'm going to turn to one more political question because though you're an experienced person when it comes to education, you've also run for office. Obviously, that's how you became superintendent. Is this something where, even in the case of the attorney general, where some may be saying, you know, please get out of the way because this might cost Republicans a seat. Do you find that either for you or anyone else you've heard from where that's part of the concern as well?
It's sort of still mellowing out there. You know, Steve, people are reeling. They're reeling because this is not the person that they knew. You know, when these things are said over a long period of time, or in the case of Tom Horn, you've had a lot of activity for a long period of time, and people are kind of establishing an opinion about that. This is new. It is contrary to what everybody believed, and I think both folks are still reeling. So I don't think that has really emerged in the campaign sense yet. And so, you know, my answer to that is, look, you're going to have to let the public process run its course. Now, we are where we are. This is what it is. And the first order of business is to deal with holding John accountable for these actions. And everything else is going to have to just follow. And, you know, we have mechanisms for that. So I don't know what they are yet, that's for sure.
Lisa Graham Keegan, former superintendent of public instruction for Arizona, calling on current superintendent John Hupenthal to resign. Lisa, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate it.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Attorney General Tom Horn has been under fire from multiple corners for months, mostly related to accusations that he helped coordinate his 2010 campaign efforts with an independent expenditure group, which is a definite no-no. And some credit the additional funding from that IEG for Horn's narrow victory over the Democratic Attorney General nominee Felicia Ronellini. Horn has denied that he violated campaign finance laws. But now he may have to face off with the Clean Elections Commission, which has given its executive director Tom Collins the go-ahead to investigate whether Horn did violate any laws. We'll talk to Tom in just a few minutes. But we start with Arizona Republic editorial writer Doug McCachern, who wrote in his Sunday column that, quote, clean elections may be stepping in the way of the people's ability to exercise their First Amendment rights in the purest way imaginable at the ballot box, end quote. And Doug McCachern joins me now to talk a bit about clean elections. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so first of all, what's the most egregious part of this for you?
Well, it's the fact that we're on the brink of an election, and people have a right to exercise their choice in this matter, have an opportunity to exercise their choice as to who should be attorney general, and we should give it to them. I think that in a fairly obscure organization like Clean Elections stepping in and assuming its right, which has been ratified by the Supreme Court. I have no objections to the technical ability of them to go forward with an investigation. But we also have a pretty solid constitutionally approved means of dealing with the situation in the vote. And I think that people should have the right to exercise that.
In your column, you talk about the enforcement provision and how, at least in some sense, based on the action by the legislature and the governor, that'll be going away soon. Do you see this as some way to sort of squeeze in before the finish line?
Well, they say no. And then they said that they would have gone forward with this, you know, regardless of what the legislature did. And I'm not going to second guess them about that. You know, frankly, here's a tip of my hat to Tom Collins and the people at Clean Elections. I think they're an upstanding group, and if they say they're not trying to get in ahead of the legislature, okay, I'll buy that. But nevertheless, I don't think that they should get in front of the people either.
You know, Doug, from a big picture standpoint, you write about this as well. There were many folks, and we've been through this with certain other provisions as well, that have been either approved by voters or others, what some would label sort of good government things that have occurred. And clean elections, you write about this. For some, perhaps it's backfired in a sense. Overall, do you think it's been something good? Do you think if voters gave another shot at it this time around, they would reject it?
I think they would. I think they would reject it. I'll give this also to clean elections. I'll note that it does, candidates running with clean election money frees them up to address issues rather than raise campaign funds. And that in of itself is a good thing. I don't deny that. What I do object to, though, is clean elections assuming that it's some kind of moral arbiter of what constitutes a good candidate. I think they're overstepping what the voters mandated them to do. If you look at the language from 1998, the voters approved Proposition 200 based on the fact that it would fund publicly fund elections. It didn't. The fact that they could conduct investigations was something written well down into the fine print of the statute.
Doug, final question for you. How do you think this Tom Horn thing is going to end up? Do you think he's going to still stay running for re-election, and do you think he'll win the primary?
I don't think he's going to win. I don't think he'll win the primary. He certainly will not win against Felicia Rodellini, who is prime for bear. She's in a great position for a candidate. I think that Horn is in serious trouble.
Doug McCackert is an editorial writer for the Arizona Republic. Doug, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now we turn to Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission, who joins me in studio. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing today? Thanks
I'm good.
For having me.
So let's talk about how important the clean elections enforcement provision is and how that relates to as much or as little as you can tell us about the Tom Horn investigation.
Okay, Steve. Well, yeah, and I do want to be clear that I'm not going to comment substantively about anything beyond what the commission's actually voted on. Mm-hmm. But you know, to take it to a policy level, as Doug was just talking about, I think it sounds like Doug is conceded or acknowledges that the Arizona Supreme Court itself has said what the Clean Elections Act itself says is that the commission has a duty to enforce all campaign finance laws that apply to state and legislative candidates through the Clean Elections Act. Mm-hmm. That's a paramount duty. That's the word the Arizona Supreme Court used. So as a policy matter, that's what the voters wanted. There's reasons why independent enforcement by a nonpartisan body that meets in open session is a good thing. In other words, by setting up a commission like the Clean Elections Commission, you provide the opportunity to not have elected officials at every end of the question of whether or not other elected officials or people participate in elections as candidates have violated the laws that people have put in place in order to keep our politics free from corruption.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the investigative approach, Tom, and what can we get into a little bit more detail about what the provision allows you to do?
Well, let me just say this about that. I mean, I wrote a recommendation to the commission, which is available. I guess it's not probably on our website, but it's out there on the web, and it's easily distributed, easily obtained. It's a public document. Let me put it that way. And that recommendation outlined, the complaint, which mm-hmm. was a sworn complaint that we received in the response. And under the commission's process, when you have in fact, we have a new rule that was instituted just this year with respect to these candidates who do not take public financing. What the commission said was, before you do anything else, executive director, you need to come to us and ask us if you can initiate an inquiry, is what the rule says. So that's what this really is. So it's a procedural vote made by the commission, based on only the sworn complaint and the response to that complaint.
Let's talk about Ken Bennett a little bit then. What did the commission have to say about his ability to appear in voter information ads or PSAs?
Well, that was another issue. I think that my recommendation and the comments of the commission, made clear that the issue isn't again about voter education mm-hmm. per se. The commission does voter education. Maricopa County, for example, right now is doing voter education. You'll see, Helen Purcell's office has been really engaged on that lately, and has been continuing. We've been working with them. Secretary's office has its voter education ideas, which is great. This has to do with when you have a clearly identified candidate in an advertisement. And also it has to do with a provision of law that talks about when you are giving money to a person who's elected official, regardless of whether or not they're running for office, is that deemed a campaign contribution? So there's two different legal issues. Really, one of them has to do with the substance of the ad itself, and one of it has to do with the financing. And the question before the commission was really whether or not they could provide Mr. Bennett a letter he could rely on, in the words of our rule, essentially as a defense, for lack of a better way of putting it. And in that context, we weren't able to do that. What happens from here is really, that's where we are. I mean, that's the end of our interaction on this particular matter for the time being.
So Secretary of State's office has said that they will probably go ahead, perhaps they already have, without Secretary Bennett in. Mm. If, in fact, he were to be in ads, are you able to speculate? Would that be a separate issue then that would have to come before?
Yeah, I oughtn't speculate. I mean, I think that, we've outlined through the memos, I mean, we've outlined what, I think the law is in terms of the contours of it in the context of the request and that rule. So outside of that, it's really not a place to do that.
Secretary Bennett qualified for clean elections funding in his race for governor. Al Melvin tried to and then wasn't able to. Andrew Thomas still in the process.
Sure.
Is this a good sign for clean elections that several of these candidates are still jumping in the mix there?
Well, I think it's a good sign actually on two different levels. One, we believe and the commission believes and the voters by voting for clean elections believe that this providing public financing is a mechanism that allows people to run who otherwise wouldn't, and it breaks the link between dollars and political favors. It creates a bulwark against corruption. That's important. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that and we don't want anyone to not succeed, but what the fact of the matter is that the fact that someone who said they wanted to do it couldn't make it demonstrates that this is not something that just happens magically. You need to actually show grassroots support and be able to put together a kind of a coalition to get folks together to get those $5 qualifying contributions, because one of the complaints that's levied that I just don't think is accurate is it's not hard enough to become a candidate. Well, I think that the example here is you have three different gubernatorial campaigns, one of whom was very, very quick to be ready, Mr. Bennett, one of whom came in with a very low level, a comparatively low level of qualifying contributions, but they were, for the most part, apparently good or were likely to be good. Most of them were good. And then a third person who couldn't put that together. That is a demonstration of the amount of work it takes to get this done and how much grassroots support you really need.
Tom, a few minutes ago I asked Doug McCachern if voters know what they know now as far as the 1998 is concerned, how clean elections has gone. He thinks they'd reject it.
Well, I actually think that if voters were, if voters had the similar questions, I think today they would reaffirm clean elections and or enhance clean elections. The fact of the matter is that the issues of corruption, the issues of money's corrupting effects in politics are not going away. And the legal regime, the constitutional regime that we live under because of the appointments of John Roberts and Samuel Alito has changed. No one can deny that. But what I would suggest is that within the regime we have, the need for independent enforcement is just as great. The need for bulwarks against corruption is just as great, because the people in John Roberts don't really agree about how this works. And at the end of the day, we think that we're effective. And I think that, you yourself actually, right after the legislative session, reported on the 1344 bill, and you and I talked mm-hmm. about how that bill actually works, and it doesn't touch Article 2 of Chapter 6. And I don't mean to be technical, but it's not a technical point, because the bill was actually specifically amended on the floor of the Senate to exclude Article 2 of Chapter 6 of Title 16. You know what that is? That's the Clean Elections Act.
Uh-huh.
So once that happened explicitly, there's really not an argument about the spirit or the letter. This is, this is the law. We do law. We don't do politics.
Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Thunderbird School of Global Management in Glendale has faced significant financial problems. Not long ago, a merger opportunity collapsed, at least in part because of strong opposition from some alumni. Last week, Arizona State announced plans to partner with Starbucks on a tuition plan to get more of the coffee company's employees to become ASU online students. So with ASU in partnership mode, could Thunderbird be a target? Mike Sunnix of the Phoenix Business Journal wrote about that earlier this week and joins me now. Mike, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, so what, if anything, has ASU told you about this?
Both schools won't talk at all. And, I find that interesting because ASU is usually very, very pro-media and ready to comment on everything. So when they declined to confirm or deny that they were talking to Thunderbird about a merger or alliance or partnership, it kind of showed that there's some meat there. The two schools have talked before. Thunderbird's had a lot of discussions with various schools over the years, and they had talked before Thunderbird had this deal with Laureate Education, which is a for-profit group out of Baltimore that owns a bunch of colleges throughout the world. When that deal kind of ended earlier this year, I think the ASU talks started up again.
All right, Mike, give us a little bit of background, not much, but just a little bit, sort of a Cliff Notes version of what's going on with Thunderbird, and do we have any idea what an ASU-Thunderbird merger would look like? Does this mean the W.P. Carey School of Business is somehow folded over into Thunderbird? Any speculation about that?
Yeah, that's some of the devil in the details, what you would do with the existing ASU Business School, whose reputation has really improved over the years. There's also the naming rights. The W.P. Carey gave money to them. And so how do you fold that into the Thunderbird name, or do you keep Thunderbird independent? That's kind of what the Thunderbird alumni and students, you know, want. They are open to it, though, the Thunderbird folks. A lot of Thunderbird alumni and students and faculty were really opposed to this Laureate deal, because Laureate was a for-profit school, and they're worried about that on the image. But you talk to them, and they like Michael Crow. They see him as kind of a visionary guy, a good fundraiser, someone that's raised ASU and the business school, his reputation there. But the challenge is, you know, what do you do with the existing two schools? What do you do with Thunderbird's campus? Is it independent? You know, how do you mesh the different programs and stuff? Thunderbird's been around since, you know, after World War II. It's a prestigious international business school, mm-hmm. always ranks very high, but its problem is its business model is a little outdated. They have a lot of competition from a lot of schools for MBAs and executive education, and their endowment and their enrollment are very small. So they're at the prestigious level of Ivy League business schools, but their endowment and their financials are nowhere close to an Ivy League or top-notch school. So bringing in a partner like ASU would give them, maybe give them the financial stability that they need. They have a lot of debt, and it would give them the marketing prowess, and obviously you have Crow out there that would help them raise some money.
And Mike, to speculate further, let's get down to brass tacks here. ASU, of course, public university. Michael Crow has not been shy about his expressions toward Grand Canyon University, a for-profit. Where is Thunderbird? Who funds Thunderbird? How does that work?
Thunderbird's a nonprofit, traditional private university. It's just they're a niche school. They right now, for years, they've just had graduate business programs. Their enrollment's pretty small, but it's very prestigious. They have a lot of international students that come in there. A lot of companies, ExxonMobil, a lot of multinationals hire them for executive education. They have some international centers, Geneva, where they run some programs too. So it's a very prestigious school. It was interesting that you mentioned Grand Canyon and Crow. Crow made some critical comments of Thunderbird's Laureate deal when that was announced, that they were chasing the money because Thunderbird had been talking to ASU and a couple other schools about a merger or alliance, and then they announced this thing with Laureate. So yeah, Dr. Crow has a pretty standard opposition to for-profit schools.
Mike, very interesting story. Mike Sunnix of the Phoenix Business Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about tomorrow's NBA draft and what the Phoenix Suns might do. And then a little bit later on, we'll introduce you to Jenny Molan. She's an actress and a comic writer. She's also the daughter of a very well-known Valley doctor. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Copper Point Mutual Insurance Company, formerly SCF Arizona, providing workers' compensation insurance to more than 20,000 Arizona businesses for over 85 years. CopperPoint.com, at work for you.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Look for sunny skies in the valley today. We should see a high near 107 degrees. 106 is average. Clear tonight with an overnight low near 81, and then 107 for the high again tomorrow. Coming up at 12, we'll have NPR's Here and Now. Today, an update on yesterday's primary elections around the country. And drone technology is helping to restore one of the oldest buildings in Camden, New Jersey. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. In Valley traffic on the Loop 202 Red Mountain Freeway, a crash is blocking the shoulder at Val Vista. Sunny skies and 99 degrees in Phoenix at 11:45.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The just-completed NBA season was supposed to be a dismal one for the Phoenix Suns. Most pundits expected them to lose between 55 and 60 of their 82 regular season games. But even though the Suns weren't able to make the playoffs, they did surprise the league by winning 48 games. So with the NBA draft taking place tomorrow and with three first-round picks, the Suns' better-than-expected year changed their strategy of building with young players. Will they try to make a splash by signing a big-name free agent? Here to talk with me for a few minutes is Kevin Zimmerman, who covers the Suns and is the editor of valleyofthesuns.com. Hi, Kevin.
How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us. So let's just speculate a little bit. LeBron James has opted out of his contract. Carmelo Anthony, another NBA star, has opted out of his contract. Before we get to the draft, any chance the Suns pursue those players?
There's a chance. I mean, you would be kind of silly not to at least look into it. The Suns have the ability to sign one of those guys to a max contract deal. They'd have to clear maybe one contract, two contracts, maybe trade away some of these draft picks just to open up the salary space. But they could theoretically sign LeBron James and even re-sign guard Eric Bledsoe, who's a free agent also.
Is this one of those things that is in the realm of possibility, though, or is it just something worth exploring?
I think it's something just worth exploring. I mean, they certainly could be a good place for LeBron to land, but he's probably leaning toward Miami right now, and then there's the Clippers out there who are rumored to be looking into getting him the Rockets, so there are a lot of teams in this race for LeBron. But you never know. It's a crazy league.
Suns forward Channing Frye, who a lot of our listeners would know either from his play at St. Mary's High or at the U of A, he's opted out of his contract, so he is a free agent at this point. He has, obviously, as I mentioned, local ties here. He came back from a serious heart ailment and was really one of the leaders of the team. What do you anticipate with him? Are they going to try to re-sign him?
Yeah, I think they'll look into re-signing him. He wants a longer-term deal. He might even take a pay cut. He was bound to make $6.8 million this coming year. But, you know, he wants long-term stability, and he does like Phoenix. Phoenix loves him. He is a unique player. He can shoot the three from the power forward spot. So certainly they're going to look into it. But if another team comes into the mix, then perhaps he's a little out of their price range. The Golden State Warriors are one of those teams. Former Suns GM Steve Kerr and coach Alvin Gentry are out there. So it'll be interesting to see if they can retain him.
Kevin, I know you're not a doctor, but I'll ask you this anyway. Are there any thoughts about, as I mentioned, the health issue with Channing Frye with his heart ailment? Is that considered to be cleared up? And that might be something where teams might not want to risk a longer-term contract, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think from everything I read about it and learned about that ailment, it really is kind of in the past. They kind of called it, they made a comparison to it being like a virus where, you know, he had an enlarged heart, but it cleared up, and it's really just one of those things that seems to be in the past from all my knowledge.
So in our last couple of minutes, let's look at tomorrow night's NBA draft. As I mentioned, the Suns have three first-round draft picks. What are the possible strategies on that? One would think with the way the roster is made up, they wouldn't use all three of those picks, but what are the options?
Yeah, the options are definitely they're going to try to make some moves because bringing in three rookies, considering all the players on the roster already, would be difficult to fit them in. So the options there are package some picks to get a star. Kevin Love obviously is out of there. They could also move up in the draft, maybe use one of those picks, two of those picks, excuse me, to move up. The other option is they could take an international player, and that would be beneficial just to give them an asset, but also to have a player growing overseas. They don't bring him over immediately, and then they don't fill a roster spot this year. Maybe have a good player down the line.
And Kevin, as somebody who follows the team, and you're obviously a fan of the team as well, What are some of the risks? Because obviously, they, as I mentioned before, they're hugely pleasant surprise how the Suns played this last season. What do you think fans are willing to accept going forward? Are they willing to say, okay, get a good young player and maybe win a few less games, but then sort of bounce back with a stronger team? Or do you think this is the offseason they really need to get that more established star?
I think that there's not a panic right now. I mean, when you look at the roster, they can win a lot of games next year if they keep it somewhat similar and re-sign Bledsoe especially. They can get some young players in this draft. I think the one thing that general manager Ryan McDonough hasn't done is he hasn't put the pressure on himself and the fan bases along with him to, you know, panic and make a big trade for Kevin Love and maybe trade all of these young players and kind of gut the roster. I think they're going to be very careful because next year a lot of contracts come off the books and they'll be able to go after some free agents then. And there are a lot more free agents next year, even though LeBron and Carmelo Anthony obviously are huge names this year.
So the NBA draft is tomorrow night. We just talked about it with Kevin Zimmerman. You can read his stuff about the Phoenix Suns at valleyofthesuns.com. Kevin, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. What if you were an actress who kept narrowly missing out on the jobs you really wanted? And what if you were married to a pretty famous actor who has more Twitter followers than you do? If you're Jenny Molin, you write a book and try to get people to laugh with you and at your pain. Molin is the author of I Like You Just the Way I Am. It's a very open, some might say graphic, account of her life, her marriage to actor Jason Biggs, and growing up in Phoenix as the daughter of Dr. Art Molin, who for decades has been the go-to expert for a number of local TV stations. Molin will be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe tomorrow night. I caught up with her earlier as she was driving around Los Angeles and asked her whether she's being completely open in her book or holding something back.
I don't really hold back a lot, I have to say. I don't really know how to hold back. That's sort of my problem. I'm working on it.
People are so used to someone saying stuff, they feel like, wow, no one says these, and then they just presume you're not saying everything. But, well, how did you feel about opening up this much? How do you get to the point where you wanted to open up?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's not that I'm not just as embarrassed as the next person about all of these crazy misadventures I find myself getting into, but I'm not ashamed of them, and it makes me feel, I think, more sane to be able to talk about them than holding them inside.
People probably, even now, still kind of stereotype a funny woman, how a funny woman should be. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about what maybe the perception of what they expect a funny female to be as opposed to a funny man?
Well, I think that people expect a funny female to be sort of like slutty and body and just kind of out there in a different way. I think that men can get away with things that women can't. People meet me in person and I'm oftentimes shocked by how normal I come across. I think they expect me to be this like outlandish, crazy sexual predator. And I'm not. I'm just like an honest person talking about, you know, my inner world. I'm not actually that wild. Sort of, I think people are disappointed.
So did the writing free you up to be the person maybe inside you are that most of us wouldn't get a chance to know?
Well, the writing definitely offers you the ability to, I don't know, just sort of delve into topics that maybe I wouldn't bring up at a dinner party. But I don't know, knowing me, it's like I do at a dinner party. I want to talk about my husband's ex-girlfriend. So I don't know. I do get into these topics in person, but I got to really elaborate on them with the book.
How much has being this open, funny writer affected your overall career? Because you, even in the book, you kind of pigeonhole yourself as someone who almost makes it, but then sort of loses certain gigs. But now you're this known writer. People know how funny you are. Is this going to help your career?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's my dad calling on the other line. Hold on. He's just being annoying. Let me send him the voicemail. It's helped me with my dad because now he thinks I'm a big deal. So don't tell him I'm not. But no, I don't know. I don't know that I'm... even with the book, I feel like I've almost made it, but I'm not sure because I don't really know what any of this is going to translate to be honest. Just like, yeah, I'm happy the book is out there. I'm thrilled that people are reading it, but I don't know. I don't know. I don't have numbers in front of me. I don't know, like, what it's going to do. So right now, I still feel like that person that almost made it, I guess I should say.
Well, from the career standpoint, then, I mean, what would you want it to turn into? Would you want it to be Jenny Molin turning into, like, a Seinfeld kind of sitcom? Would you want to be a lead in a movie? What would you want it to?
Right now, I'm working with some people. We're going to take this out as a pilot. So that's the next step. That's what's happening right currently. And I'd love to see that come to fruition, of course. But I've been here too long to get my hopes up. I know how many pilots get made a year. So
yeah.
So you know, I'm just trying to enjoy what's happening right now.
I'm glad you mentioned your dad because I grew up in Phoenix myself. So your dad has been like the go-to TV doctor in Phoenix for decades. So what was it like living with a local celebrity first? And then how has your dad reacted to how you characterize him in the book, which is funny, but also like even the fact that is there really a photo of your dad holding a photo of himself? Because if that's true, that's hilarious.
But there are enough photos of my dad in his house alone that I felt justified in writing that.
Okay.
Enough framed photos of him that I felt like that was basically the next step. My dad likes to think that I just like exaggerate everything and that it's all a work of fiction. And I think he's probably himself going to be shocked when he goes to the bookstore and it's not in the fiction aisle. But but yeah, I think he's proud. I think he's a little upset that I included certain things about him. But I couldn't help it. And I honestly, most women in Arizona who, you know, haven't been married for years have probably dated my dad. So they probably agree with my description of him.
Can you take us back a little bit, just a little bit, based on what you're right about with him? Did it feel like you were living with a local celebrity?
At times, yeah, for sure. I'd go to the mall and everyone would be like, hey, Dr. Art. They loved it. It always got us, like, lots of extra chips and salsa at Ajo El's.
All right, now who's more famous now, you or your dad?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that would really... I hope that I am. I don't know. In his mind, I think he always will be, though.
Okay. You write a lot about your mom in the book, too. Now, how's being a mom changed how you view life? I mean, are there things that... Obviously, make a lot of fun of your mom, too. Are there things that you learn from her that are good things and bad things and that are going to make you a better mom or no?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think my mom, the thing about my mom that I love and I will always be so grateful for is that she was so open and just, you know, honest about kind of who she was. She was wild and crazy, but she didn't shelter us and she didn't really try to, like, pretend that she wasn't who she was. And I think I have that sort of internal just need to just rebel because I saw my mom doing it all the time.
Yeah.
And she embraced that part of herself. And I feel like that's why I can be so kind of like, you know, out there with the things that I put out. I don't feel any shame around it because, you know, my mom did a lot of crazy things and didn't have remorse about it.
All right, we talked about Twitter and how hot you are on Twitter and how funny you are and all the writing you've done. You wanted to be an actress, but did you think of yourself as a funny person too, or did that develop as you became more mature?
No, I think I just like eventually started laughing at all of my pain. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should, you know, maybe I am funny. I don't know. I think meeting Jason is really when I found my voice.
Well, did he think you were funny or was he just, because he loved you, he wanted to encourage you more and then you found out that you were funny?
No, I think he thinks I'm like the most hilarious person he's ever met.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
He's not here right now, so I can say that. But no, I really do. I think that Jason thinks I'm so funny. And that was, I think when he started saying, you're so funny, I had to look at myself and say, am I funny? Maybe I am.
That's actress and author Jenny Molin. Her new book is called I Like You Just the Way I Am. She'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore tomorrow night in Tempe. And Jenny tells us there's a possibility as well that her husband, the more famous actor Jason Biggs, and her father, local celebrity Dr. Art Molin, will be at that book signing as well. That's tomorrow night at Changing Hands. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry, also Bruce Drummond, for their help on the program. If you missed any of our segments or you just want to catch up with Here and Now, go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.